Hello, and welcome to the Emergence Education Press author interview series. My name is Amy Edelstein, and I'm here with Philip Moore.
Hi, Amy, and hi out there.
We're going to speak about the principles and experiences behind Phil's new book entitled The Future of Children. And as good fortune or synchronicity would have it, Philip and I are recording this interview from the Karen Joy Theater at the Upland Hills School. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Phil's background, which will hardly begin to tell you about who he is and the vision behind the work, but we're going to do our best to articulate what's moving this great vision and work on the future of children and the future of education. Philip Moore began teaching at Upland Hills Farm School in 1971, and he served as the director of Upland Hills School for 42 years, building a profound learning community for the students, teachers, board, and I think everyone affiliated with the school. Among many moving stories of transformation and growth with the individual children who attended the school, Phil's been involved in everything from raising $1.5 million for 31 acres of land, building a wind-powered geodesic dome, a 6-classroom schoolhouse, a wind and solar-powered sod-roofed ecological awareness center, and a performance theater that seats 150 people. Over this time, Phil and his wife Karen, who also teaches and serves a central role in Upland Hills School, raised 2 amazing children, both of whom attended this school full term, and who now have 5 children of their own, all of whom are continuing the legacy of creativity and love that is very much part of Upland Hills School. Now that his tenure as hands-on director of the school has ended, Philip has begun new ventures of his rewirement. This includes developing a team to guide and collaborate new education initiatives that have the capacity to transform our cultural consciousness. He does this through his new business called TrimTab. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you, Amy. It's so nice to be on home ground, actually, to be surrounded by this forest that Karen and I have been living in for the last 45 years. So it's a very special opportunity to be here at Upland Hills School in the Karen Joy Theater, so close to the essence of the land and how the land communicates to us and is very much a part of the magic of this place.
I thought it'd be great to create a little bit of a picture for our listeners. Would you be willing to describe the amazing school grounds that we're sitting in right now, its buildings, the surroundings around it, all the components and spaces, so everyone can get a more tactile sense of the structures that support the paradigm in education that you've been working with for the last 4 decades?
Well, I'll start with the when I came here first, which was in 1970, and visited Upland Hills Farm. It was initiated by Knight and Dorothy Webster in 1960. They came to this part of the world, the northeast corner of Oakland County, which is still relatively wild. Even though it's a very wealthy and populated county, this northeast corner of it is a wild place, which is amazing, really, because I grew up in Oakland County and went to Royal Oaks Schools and lived in a suburb called Huntington Woods. And that part of the world was definitely not wild. This place, Upland Hills Farm, was dedicated and still is dedicated in its second generation to teaching children where their food and fiber come from. It's a 240-acre farm, and really most human beings who've come here, perhaps over 1 million since they opened in 1960, only see the 4 or 5 acres that are off of Lake George Road. Back in the northeast corner of Upland Hills Farm is Upland Hills School. And that began really in 1972, is when we began to develop this place here that is known as Upland Hills School. And that development was really a part of my rewirement in early adulthood was to understand that taking on an initiative like creating a new paradigm school and living in it meant that I would be a contractor and I would be an engineer and I would be a designer and I would be a crummy builder and I would be a lot of things in order to get it done, in order to make it happen. So, and mostly I would say the chief characteristic of that time, the when I look back on it, I would be naive about all of those things and what it would take to do it. The difference between what we saw when we were here in 1972 looking for a place for the school is that these beautiful, gentle, rolling hills, which were formed by the glacial moraine in this area, which is quite different than the rest of southern Michigan. And that's why it was called Upland Hills, because it has these beautiful hills. And as we rise to the north, it gets to 1,000 feet above sea level. So for here, this is really a Michigan mountain. And we're right at the edge of the top of that mountain. And these hills were mostly open fields. But because of the children and because of the nature of the school, which is to have the natural world as a primary teacher, it now looks like a rainforest. It looks like a mature, lush, green rainforest. And it's so beautiful. And nestled within this rainforest, there is the Karen Joy Theater, which is the first thing you would see as you walked from the Apple Tree parking lot down a few steps and then across and then up a few steps. You would see this beautiful theater nestled into the hill. And that is where we are right now. And that building, this building was finished in 2003. So it's only between 2003 and now that we've had a really amazing space for Karen and her cohort, Ted Strunk, to be able to work their magic with children. In this sound booth, there are kids. Backstage, there are kids. All the actors are kids. The miracle that happens in terms of the collaboration and the artistic and creative endeavor of the whole experience of doing a play begins as soon as the lights dim, and then it's all completely the children. That is a metaphor for the current paradigm, the paradigm that we have been so fortunate to occupy for these last 45 years. Because that's, I think many teachers aspire to do just that. You've done your work, you've done your scaffolding, you've worked with the kids, you've helped them draw out their genius, their gifts, and now, through the beautiful magic of live performance, it's yours. The stage is yours. And the moment is yours. And the teachers are no longer key to anything. They're just invisible. We're in the theater. Very often for me, I'm watching parents. I also know the stories behind these children. You know, a child who came who was so shy, she hid underneath a table for the first 2 days she was at school. And now she's the lead in this particular production and she's singing in front of all these people. So I get to see that kind of magic unfold here in the theater and in so many ways, the collaboration, the artistic moment, owning that moment and it being live and real and now is what the school is all about. So I've only gotten to the theater.
What you did describe was the beautiful support that the teachers are for the students and how the way that the school is structured, that's given primary importance and significance. And I'm sure you'll describe more aspects of the terrain and the way you work with the kids and the unusual projects they do. I think that what characterizes Upland Hills School is that dedication and communal support and real 360 awareness of each child, their gifts, their needs, with a lot of freedom, without the kind of helicopter education or parenting that can suffocate a child's creativity. What comes out is, of course, love. And your subtitle of your book is Providing a Love-Based Education for Every Child. Talk a little bit more about what you mean by love-based education, and can that be a real education, and can that train students in the ways that they need to function in the world, to get good employment in this complicated technological culture that we live in now. So describe a little bit more about the love-based element of the teaching.
It took a while for me to get to a very simple way of explaining what it is that we do here. And so there was an evolution from the very beginning of the school to now. And we were singing an anthem right at the very first year of school. So the very first year of school, we sang All You Need Is Love by the Beatles. Very, very early in the very first aspect of the songbook for Upland Hills School, that was a central song for us. So we were singing, you know, nothing you can do that can't be done, nothing you can know that can't be known, nothing you can make that can't be made, you know, it's easy, you know. So it was there from the very beginning, from the very beginning. But very often we were talking about developmental education, or we were talking about progressive education, or we were talking about holistic education. We were using lots of words. And there was even a time when I thought the best word to wake up the word school, because school has so many negative connotations for so many people. And it's got like this terrible cafeteria smell and these pale walls and this prison-like atmosphere of the bells ring and then you move and you only ask questions if you've given opportunity, and the questions have to be very specific and focused, and the teachers know all the answers, and the grades are going to happen to you. You know, all of the. So, what word would really wake up the word school? And that's when I read Gary Snyder's book, The Practice of the Wild, and I thought, oh, wild. We could put wild in front of school in the hopes that it would wake up the word school. And wild, in the way that Gary was using it in that brilliant collection of essays, was really about the wild card, you know, the card that could be anything you wanted it to be, or in a natural state, you know, wild foods. Nobody's planting those foods. Those foods are being planted by the wind and by the animals and by the birds, you know. So wild in terms of imagination. Wild imagination. So wild school really for a while became a part of our culture. And then it just became so simple to me at some point, because I understood that a lot of what was difficult for so many of us in traditional education was that it was fear-based, and it was fear-based by its design. You were going to compete whether you wanted to or not. You were going to be ranked and judged whether you wanted to or not. You were going to, in some cases, be ridiculed in front of your classmates, and there would be no way to check that system. That's when I woke up in elementary school, when a teacher by the name of Mrs. Hart, who I thought of as Mrs. Hartless, would be sarcastic or cruel to another of my classmates. Douglas Baker stuttered, and so whenever she would call on Douglas, and he would start to stutter, she would say things like, get it out, fat man, you know, and he was a little overweight. And I would think, you don't have the right to be a teacher. You shouldn't be here. And so I really understood that most of education, no matter how well we mean it, has at its root this thing that says there's a contest, there's an all-A student, there's somebody who in high school will get more A's than anybody else in the entire class and get a higher score on their SAT class, their SAT test or their ACT test, and we will call them the valedictorian of our high school class. So there was this immediately there was this thing that there would be one winner and a bunch of losers, or a bunch underneath that person. And then I thought, well, that's what we tried to do here from the very beginning, is create something that was completely different than that. And that would be a love-based education. And what I mean by that is that every child would be seen, and every child would be cared for, and every child would be loved into becoming and to being. You know, though both of those things were really a big aspect of our intention as teachers when we showed up every morning, is we wanted to be in love with every child. Easy. That was really easy. And then we wanted to listen beneath the surface of things to know who that child really was. So it wasn't about the confusion we had in that first year, pump the kids for the curriculum. Very quickly it became, no, this isn't a way to do a school. But you listened closely and deeply to the child and saw that's your interest, that's your passion, that's your gift. And we began to draw those things out. And then learn how to be together in a group, because you don't get to always do what you want to do. You want to be in a group, and that group has a different consciousness than an individual. So a love-based education really is a simple way of saying we're clear that we're not using fear to control or to intimidate or to threaten or to encourage, because a competitive environment can encourage somebody to do better, but there's always, as in sports, the winner and the loser. You know, so there's always that dualistic way of looking at things. And we were experimenting with consciousness. So we saw something that was beyond dualism. We saw something that said, is it possible for us to both be individuals and a collective? And then we just kept using those words, both and. Is it possible for us to both find that unique gift within every child and to do something that would benefit the entire community? So you could see how, even at the very beginning, we were playing with that. The wonderful miracle is that we've been doing it for over four decades. And so that matured, just like we do, as we're given an opportunity and we're loved into being, and we're given an opportunity to be who we were meant to be, a certain kind of maturation occurs from direct experience. And that's what the school is so about, and it makes the school so different than most places. Now, John Dewey and other educators were really very much about that. But it got translated in the industrial era, and it ended up being watered down, just like developmental theory got watered down. Most teachers and teacher training schools learn about Jean Piaget and they understand something about developmental theory. But when it comes down to being in the classroom and being in their, you know, elementary school, they're saying all 5-year-olds are kindergartners, all 6-year-olds are first graders. And then there are books, what every first grader should know, what every third grader should know. So the developmental theory is nowhere to be found in these ideas. The industrial model somehow wins out in that.
I love this natural support of children and what you were just referring to, that not all 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 13-year-olds are or should be at the same level, that they do develop differently. And you've created a situation that's intimate enough and where the teachers work collaboratively enough to support the students. There's another unique element of this which has to do with the wild and the beautiful, as you described it, the beautiful surroundings here and a kind of independence that the kids have with what often looks like is somewhat dangerous activities and projects that they take a big role in. Talk a little bit about why you feel that kids need, as you describe it, sky time, and what the wild has to do with education, which is usually seen as sitting down and paying attention, and also how the wild education and the independence and support helps your students develop and cultivate a lot the same skills that other kids do with reading and math and science.
Very early on, we started saying the natural world is a primary teacher. Because what we saw on a day-to-day basis is when the kids went outside for fruit and juice break or for fresh air break, I mean, it had different names, but when they went outside and they started playing in their boundaries, and every group from the youngest to the oldest had a different set of boundaries. So we were pretty much saying boundaries exist and you need to respect them. We want to empower you and we want you to really fully understand that we are trusting you in this empowerment exercise. And we set boundaries. Kind of every morning meeting teacher set a different set of boundaries. They're very complex because there's no fences and they're all visual and they're all geographical. So it's really funny to hear the teacher of the youngest group describe boundaries to the kids. But the thing that we did, we realized what we were doing is we were working on a meta level as well as the physical level. We were saying that we're concerned about boundaries and we will enforce them. And so if you go out of your boundaries, there's going to be consequences, mostly that you wouldn't be able to keep going out on your own. You know, you would have to have some kind of special restriction or something like that. So nothing, you know, terrible, but the kids realized that they wanted to be empowered. They wanted to be trusted. And they were aware that kids in other groups had larger boundaries. So just in that, we began to use the natural world as a primary teacher because we were describing where that hill ends or where that valley goes or where the next hill arises or where that white pine stands. Or, I mean, we're using the guardians of this place, the features, the natural features, to describe the boundaries. And then we were empowering the children. The game, really, of raising a child into being is ultimately, ironically, about letting go. There's a point at which you launch your child. And we see in the culture that we live in today how complex that's getting in terms of the way it was when I graduated from college and the way it is now when a child, a young man or a young woman graduates from college is a really different world. And so many children are still living at home, not because they want to live at home, but because financially it's so hard to deal with the debt that they're living with. So we have at our school this idea that if that's the end game, then we have to start trusting them really early on. And we want them to make choices, conscious choices. So we have to start empowering them to make those choices really early on. And what better way to do it than in the wild? Because it's different to have more privileges within four walls. You're still contained. But when you're out in nature, and it just feels like, oh, wow, this is a different game. This is really a very different kind of boundary now. And always with the sky. I would say one of the things that all of the children that have gone here, maybe 1,000 at this point, somewhere in that area, I think every one of them in some way has a special relationship with the natural world because of this opportunity to be in the natural world the way that we release them into the natural world. They fell in love. It was natural. It was just so natural for them to fall in love with the natural world. And it's not falling in love with the natural world as a naturalist might want you to do it. This is a conifer tree, and that's why these cones are here. And this is, you know, this is the way the seed mechanism of a conifer tree works. And this is what a serrated, you know, pine cone looks like. I mean, there are things that we get at nature centers, which we love and we totally support, that are very different than what we were trying to accomplish here. We were just saying, work your magic, you know, Pachamamita, just work your magic. And the kids were like, oh, I'm in love. You know, I can't wait to be outside again. I can't wait to create Woodville. At some point, a few years ago, there was a lot of elm trees that were dying of Dutch elm disease. And so big sections of the bark were coming off of these elm trees. And the kids decided that they would make something called Woodville, because they had kind of a natural material that they could use as a shingle and they could use as a wall, and all they had to do is prop up other sticks around and then put these pieces of long pieces of bark up, and they could create an inside and an outside. And Woodville ended up being this amazing project that in the end we had to document it because it was so powerful. There was a mayor of Woodville. There was a building construction code of Woodville. There were an opportunity for it to have a conflict and then resolve a conflict and then figure out how to develop and how to leave it. And all of those things happened because they were in the natural world. So the wild really does teach. And from a scientific point of view, we know that our brains wire best when we're outside and when there's so many different opportunities for us to be working with things at the edge of a pond or noticing the caddisfly larva or in all of the seasons, the different changes. So the wild becomes a teacher in so many ways on so many levels that we as a staff, all we had to do was be clear about these boundaries, to be consistent about them so that they understood we weren't messing around. There's not a lot of negotiation that happens at the school about certain things. And sometimes we see parents who are trying to listen to their children, but they're not listening to the depth of their child. They're listening to, I like only macaroni and cheese, you know, and that's the only thing I want to eat for the rest of my life. Or I want marshmallows. I want 8 marshmallows in every cup of hot cocoa. Or, you know, and if I don't get it, I throw a fit. You know, that kind of thing. That's not really what gives a child a sense of security and a sense of being trusted. That's the opposite of that, because you don't want the child running the show. So the teachers have to do things here that are very consistent and very loving. And then let them out into the natural world. Let the natural world do its thing, which is, it's always doing its thing. It's always alluring and tempting and teaching and drawing. And the children fall in love with the natural world. And then it becomes, I want to go to school. And then it translates into, I'm being trusted. I want to learn. And then it becomes, as a part of our species, I'm curious about this. I'm curious about that. You can take one curiosity from one child, and then you can really feed and fuel that curiosity. And what that does is it breeds more curiosity. So you don't have to say you have to get an A in every subject. And there's natural science and applied science, and there's English, and there's mathematics, and there's gym class, and there's, and you need to get A's in all of that, and we want you to be well-rounded. What happens very naturally with children is if you work with the curiosity that they initially have and you feed the curiosity just immediately moves to a different level. Now I'm curious about this. I was curious about raptors. Now I'm curious about plant medicines. I was curious about dinosaurs. Now I'm curious about turtles. You know, I was curious, you know, it just always moves to something larger. I was curious about the moon. I was curious about the sun and the solar experiments that we do around. Now I'm curious about the universe. You know, it just keeps moving that way. That's how curiosity works. And that's why when people come to visit at this time, it's really quite amazing because there's so much laughter and there's so much curiosity. And what I really love to look at is how little supervision is required for the kids to play really cooperatively on an impossible playground where there's a sandbox nearby and there's a swamp nearby and there's a road nearby and there's a basketball court nearby. And they all love to play on the same place and they all interact with each other. The soccer ball goes into the sandbox or into the road or, you know, into the swamp. Or, I mean, they're all interacting with each other, but they love being together. They love being in that space.
It's a magical world here. Very different, of course, from our urban schools and where there's very little wild and where there is an incredible emphasis on the need for certain skills in order to get ahead. And yet, what I see in this school, I feel many of these principles can translate into the urban environment because they have to. If we're talking about the future of education, that education is going to have to serve kids where they are. And many of them are in our larger cities and can't necessarily go to a place where there's acre after acre of wilderness around them. And yet the principles that you're talking about, although the natural world is the teacher, those principles can be embodied by what you call conscious teachers, by conscious educators. And I think a big part of what you've built here and what you cultivate in the students is supportive community. And that love-based education, although it is informed by and supported by certain elements, like a lot of time, sky time, time in the wild, it's also even more importantly, I believe, supported by the community that you're creating. To be in community as educators and as students, you have to have a dynamic interplay between teaching and learning. You have to have boundaries and you have to have curiosity. So I wanted to find out how you would describe the dynamic interplay between teaching and learning for the teachers and for the students, and how that curiosity that you spoke about now is one of the essential ingredients of creating cohesion and creating an environment that builds the type of bonds and relationship that are profound community that's so often lacking in our urban environments today.
Every time I think of the word teacher, you know, it implies to me somebody who is really curious in learning. And we have examples in our life of people like that, people who just are neotenous. They have retained youth-like characteristics into their adulthood. And they're really great people to be around because they ask questions about you and your life, and because they're noticing things, you know, and they're asking questions about those things. And you offer something and they're listening deeply, and that just awakens so much, because somebody who teaches and is teaching from their passion, teaching something that they really love to share, is automatically somebody who's wired to learn and is so curious about the world and so curious about people. So those two are interlinked, you know, in a very profound way. And it's almost like the infinity sign. You know, it's just like this flow that just keeps moving and moving and moving and generating a field. And that is what we love about teaching here, is that there are these moments that we work for. Sometimes it's really hard and we don't get them all year with the group. I mean, I know that that happens in some group constellations. There are enough difficult issues that are going on in that group that it just doesn't hit this seamless, beautiful place. And the teacher is somewhat relieved at the end of a school year because it was really a challenge. And then there are these years where all of a sudden, boom, magic happens. And it happens because all the way along the line, there's been this love and this trust and these clear boundaries and this desire for every child to be who they were meant to be. And then the group clicks. You know, that happened this year in the oldest group, and it happened in the youngest group. So when that happens, that kind of creates a field of resonance that is, oh, it's total magic. It's so hard to describe, and for me, who tears up so frequently, it's impossible for me to go into detail because I begin to cry, because the beauty of it is there's so much love and so much compassion and so much openness and inquiry, and things are being solved as they arise, and you don't have to do it. So essentially what happens is a kind of sustainability sets in the consciousness. When that happens, teachers can almost go, oh my gosh, I'm irrelevant. I don't even need to be here. I'm standing at the edge of this playground because I'm on overview. We have a staff member assigned in the afternoons to something called overview. So I'm standing here because I want to, you know, be doing what I'm supposed to be doing, seeing how the kids are doing all around the school. But clearly, I am totally not necessary. And when it's really amazing to see a conflict, you know, arise and then get resolved, and you're not involved with it at all. This happens frequently here. And to me, it's the greatest joy, because you feel like that's it. That's what we were. It's almost like you're done, you can go off, but you're only seven. You know, no, you need some more time. You know, and they don't want to go, you know. So you want them to get to the point where they say, as Jesse said at some point, okay, my friends are graduating in eighth grade and I'm in seventh grade. I would be in the equivalent, you know. He was sharp enough to understand that we didn't really like these grades. And so he would say, I would be in the equivalent of seventh grade, and my friends are in the eighth grade, and I've had enough of this place. I've been here since I'm 5 years old. I'm ready for the big world. Bye. You know, so we have that. And when a child is ready to do that, it's like that's the time to release them. You know, if you're going to put them into the wild, do it when they say, I'm ready. You know, we didn't say to Jesse's parents, no, we think he needs another year to finish. We do say that to some parents on behalf of some kids, you know, even when the parents say, I want the child to go on. We even sometimes say, it's the end of the eighth grade and one more year would really make a huge difference in this child's life. And sometimes they agree with us and they listen to us, and sometimes they don't. Either way, we bless the whole situation. I mean, we're not saying that this is the agenda and you have to do what we want you to do. It's just we sometimes have been able to, from our past experience and from our cumulative experience, agreed upon, you know, if Ayla had one more year here, it would really make a huge difference in her ability to deal with all of the unknowns that she's going to experience in high school. And when parents align with that and say, you know, we trust you and we're going to do that, we're going to have her attend one more year, then we sometimes see, you know, whether it was true or not. Very often it is, sometimes it isn't. We don't always get it right. It's very intuitive here. So I think in just talking about teaching and learning, it's important to bring in a word or a couple of words that Jean Houston uses. And Jean is a very powerful influence on our school. And she has done a teaching here in this theater. And she calls people like the ones I'm describing, the staff members, social artists. And I love that phrase, because that's really what it is. There's something going on in terms of the groups and the individuals and the community as a whole, the natural world communicating to all of us every day, you know, the sky communicating to all of us every day, the sun communicating to us, all of us every day, all of those things, the clouds are communicating to us. There's something that requires social artistry, someone who really gets that this is something that I have to co-create a field that makes it work. And that teaching and learning thing is the sacred thing that I think most teachers who go into teaching, really in their core, they desire that more than anything else. It may never get articulated in any of their classes or any of their school experience, but I really believe that most teachers who really want to teach and want to be with children are social artists. They want to become social artists, and they want to create these situations that I've just described where I'm no longer necessary. The kids are getting along so beautifully. I could leave and they wouldn't even notice.
Do you feel like you're in a state of constant learning from this? And do you feel like your teachers, part of the community that they're creating, is a community of learning from each other? Is that part of what makes this magic?
Yes, we generate a field of neoteny. So this field is really about keeping youth-like characteristics alive and vibrant, whether they be laughter or whether they be dance or whether they be humor. These are all neotenous traits. And what happens when it's working is that we clearly are communicating that through our relationships with each other. Very often, Ted and I are hugging, and when we see each other, and Karen and Ted are hugging, and Holly and I are hugging, and Holly and Karen are hugging, and Jean is hugging, and you know, they see how much we love being together. And that really brings a great deal of reassurance to them. They may not see it at home sometimes. You know, they may come from a home and they're a single parent. There's just a mom and raising, you know, a child. Or there's a dad raising children, you know. And here at school, seeing that and feeling that and looking at that and being a part of that, it helps them quite a lot. And then once that field is in place, it sustains itself. It encourages us. And it's not all human. It's really deeply connected to this wild aspect. It's connected to the trees. It's amazing for me to see a piece of a film that happened here when we had something called the Eco Fair. It was probably 1976 or 1977. And there was a 16 millimeter, there were a couple of cameras, you know, documenting this event. And there were people, there were belly dancers, and there were people painting faces, and there was hot air balloon, you know, kits being made, and there was food, and there were all these things that you would have at a fair, but it was ecologically sustainable, and it was all curated in a certain way. But the most important thing for me when I looked at it was just how young this land looked at that time. I just noticed that we were playing ultimate frisbee in a valley right now where you can't hardly see the space to throw a frisbee 5 feet in front of you because so many things have grown up in that valley. And I realize now that, you know, the trees, especially the trees, have just matured in a way that's profound. And that has changed everything here. It's like we're all growing together. You know, we have relationship with these trees, and when we're not near them, you know, we're missing something. There's something that just isn't there. And so in an urban environment, of course, we have parks, and we also always have sky, and then we have amazing plants that do amazing things. We've all seen dandelions in the crack of a sidewalk, and we've seen things on the sides of buildings. You know, we see that there's this natural world always around us. All we have to do is look at it. In cities, there's a concentration of things like museums and there's parks and there's opportunities to really see what our species can do when we collaborate and when we really create. And there, almost every city has things that are just so amazing. And so there are ways that we can do this kind of work and be deeply connected to it and, you know, be in an urban environment and wake up. And I'm just clear that it has to do with that social artistry. It has to do with the staff loving each other and loving where they are and loving children into being. And I know that even in the most arid deserts, this kind of thing can flourish because I've seen it. I've been in the desert in Morocco, and I've seen the communities that live there, and I've looked into the eyes of the children, and there's just no question that the natural world is speaking to these children, and these children are deeply in love with the desert, and they are, you know, they are wired to be alive and vibrant in that environment. And if you can be alive in that environment, you can be alive anywhere.
You talk a lot about in your own life and in your work and in your philosophical musings about consciousness, about the field which you referred to between us, not the natural field that you see the hay and weeds in, but the field that exists in an environment. And that's something that you've been exploring, I think, quite a bit. and something that you describe as you can feel when the magic happens. Can you talk a little bit more about how you see the interplay between our awareness, effort, boundary holding, discipline, guidance, giving kids tasks, assignments, books to read, homework to produce, projects to create, and this magic in the field of consciousness?
Well, I think of the words field trip, you know, and so I want to relate that to the dominant paradigm. When I was in school in the 50s and the 60s, field trip really meant something outside of the boundaries of school. And it was almost always an amazing experience of some sort because we were together and we were at the Detroit Zoo, or we were together and we were in the Detroit Library. Wherever the field trip was, you know, there was something there. And in the gross realm, field trip means that. In the subtle realm, field trip to me means that we create in the subtle realm, the realm of our dreams, when we go to sleep every night and we dream, you know, that there's the subtle realm. The subtle realm is very often with children, the intuition of a child or the sensitivity of a child. So you can get close to a child, and there's certain children who just immediately radiate this healing energy, and you're attracted to them, and they attract other children. And you can see how powerful this subtle realm is. In our school, what we're trying to do is turn up the volume of the subtle realm with everybody and to see the gift in every human being that's here. So it's almost like part of what we're doing is as if we had on our belly buttons a little knob, you know, and as if this wasn't something that was a boundary crossing. We're in our consciousness, I'm looking into your eyes right now, and I just see the gift that you are as a human being. And what I really want to do more than anything else is reach in and turn the volume up. I want that gift to get even more profound. You know, I want your delight. I want your insight. I want your intuition. I want your creativity. I want all of those things to be turned up. So when you're doing that all around with everybody, and the kids see that you're doing it and that it's okay to do that, and they start doing it, the first thing that happens is you notice that they do it better than you sometimes. There are some kids who just know how to do that better than you know how to do it. That's always like, wow, that's wonderful. This generation of kids can do that. And so, and sometimes it's just for a few years. I've seen a child like that at 5 and 6 and then kind of lose it somewhat at 7 and 8 and then get it back again at 9 and 10. So there's no generalized principle other than it exists in all of us. I really fully believe that this imagination and this power to generate this consciousness belongs in every single one of us. We have it. It's in our DNA. And so just turning up that volume some is really an important aspect of a place like this because everybody's doing it. We're all doing it. And when we do it to such a degree, then certain magical things occur. And because, I don't know if magic is the right word to use, but the word synchronicities, you know, like as if it was a field, not as if it was something that was happening to me. You know, some people use the word synchronicity to mean, oh, that was meant to happen and that sign was meant to happen for me and that's why I have to go to India because I met the third person who's been to India and this was a synchronicity just for me. And I would think of it differently. I would think that there's a field that if you just lean into that field and other people are leaning into that field, we see all of these things happening and they're kind of non-simultaneous events that really feel like they're a field that are connecting us, and you ask questions something like, did you ever think about somebody and then they phoned you and that in that moment and you'd go, oh my God, I was just thinking about you. That was really a coincidence or that was serendipitous. I mean, when you start asking questions like that with people, You know, you begin to see that more people than you might imagine are feeling this subtle realm. And the magic perhaps isn't the best word, but there's something mystical that occurs. There's something about the great mystery of being alive and the fact that it's what we don't know, that's the biggest domain. And when that happens, it kind of like brings chills to us, because there's this sense of, oh, you mean we could be like this? You know, we could actually love each other this openly, or we could be this creative, or we could take these kinds of risks, you know, because a lot of what happens in our dominant culture is a judgment-based. And that judgment-based is not like, oh, I want to just stand up in front of you and sing a song. You know, the judgment-based is, oh, you, if you have a horrible voice, you are going to be laughed at. And then you'll have to deal with that trauma for the rest of your life. And actually, what I love about the school here is that people who don't have a great voice are encouraged to sing. That's really different. As strange as it may sound, that's really different. You know, it's like, yeah, let's hear you sing, Ken. You know, you love music. And, well, but I don't want to be, you know, I'm off key. And said, that's okay. We want your voice. It's not a competition. Nobody's going to record us. We just want to hear you sing, you know. And that really makes a different kind of field. And once that field is trusted, the great mystery takes over. It's not really always self-authoring. It's not us that are doing it. You know, we had to grow through a phase where I have to admit that's what I thought we were doing and that's who we were. And then I realized, oh my God, it became humorous. I would look back at that Phil and I would go, oh my God, you were so full of yourself. I've had my fill, you know. It was like, oh, and I would start laughing and crying at the same time, because we have to go through these growths and this reflection and this consciousness. That's why I use the word so much, because I can't think of anything better to say than we have to become more conscious. So when we do become more conscious and self-aware, I think that's the hallmark of our species. Self-awareness is really the thing that is really squelched in traditional dominant paradigm educational settings, and it is the key to our liberation. So there's the irony, you know.
You're coming to a different phase of your life and your career after 40-some years as the director of the school and now handing that directorship over to the next generation of directors of Upland Hills Schools. And you call this your rewirement, not retirement. Tell us a little bit about what your vision is, why you use that word, what you see in the future, and what you're hoping to accomplish in this next phase, or what you're hoping to feel into, or what you're hoping is going to reveal itself to you, or the muse that you're following right now?
Well, I can't take credit for the word. I was on Facebook and I said something about, you know, I don't want to be tired all over again. So that's how I was reading retired, you know. I'm looking for another word, and I think a woman by the name of Linda Bowers, who I know really well, she said, what about rewirement? And I don't know where she got that word, but I immediately felt like that'll be a placeholder, at least for now. And what I know about rewirement is that when I met Buckminster Fuller and I started listening to his lectures and I started reading his books and being in his presence, you know, I know that I was being rewired. I was seeing the world in a very different way. And I would say something about two quadrants that Ken Wilber, you know, has mapped out in his four quadrant system, the I quadrant and the its quadrant. I would say the its quadrant for me, whole systems, how we see whole systems and the interrelatedness of whole systems. And that's really important. So part of my rewirement is I'm rewiring to a larger worldview than I have been just by leaving the school. and going out into the world and being in the world and not just in the world as a tourist. I have no real interest in tourism for me, but I have a lot of excitement about going to another place and being with other people who are wanting to shift the educational paradigm. So I was just in Barcelona with a group of 300 to 400 people doing something called Mind Valley University, which is a brilliant initiative. And being in Barcelona for that reason was a boost to my rewirement. The people that I met, the conversations that we had, the learning that took place, whether it was with Neil Donald Walsh or whether it was with Vishen, who was the mastermind behind Mind Valley University, whether it was with the children that I met there in the children's program and how much I enjoyed meeting them and learning from them and listening from them. It really was nourishment and is nourishment to me. So that's part of what I mean by rewirement. And then in the self-awareness quadrant, in the I quadrant, I see it as a continued effort to really move into consciousness, which brings us to our weekend here with Jeff and with you, is that this non-dual consciousness, this consciousness that allows us to enter into a state of awareness where we really are rewired to experience everything from a drink of water to a walk in the woods from multiple different perspectives, and to experience it in a way that doesn't have that sense of separation always, that I'm separate from it. You know, this is the forest. You know, I now experience myself as being the forest. When I'm out of the forest, I'm not being it as much as when I'm in the forest, but I carry it with me. There's no question in my mind that, you know, the forest and I are really interlinked. And so is fresh water. Growing up in the Great Lakes bioregion, I'm attracted to fresh water. It's the thing that I love to drink the most. It's the when I want to cool myself off, I don't really think about air conditioning. I think about jumping into a cold body of water. And the water's calling me. It's not like, oh, I'm doing it. I'm going to Lake Michigan. I'm jumping in the water, and then I'm going back in the sauna, and then I'm going into the water. It's like the water is going, here I am. We're in love. Make love. Jump inside. And so rewirement for this period of time is meant being involved with Gordy Ball and with Eleanor Bazaar in something called the Exploration Center, and wanting to disrupt education through creating exploration centers throughout the world. It means writing this book, in which I talked about for far too long, and then finally, thanks to meeting you and Jeff a year ago, finally got it finished and out into the world as an artifact. The initiatives that we're doing with Conscious Teachers here tomorrow, we're working with a small group of teachers who are under that banner of Conscious Teachers and having these weekends together. I just am loving this experience. Every time that I get on a plane, there's a part of me that goes, why am I doing this? You know, I really don't like travel that much, but why am I doing this? And then when I get there and the magic begins and the great mystery begins to reveal itself, I realize, oh, this is why I'm here, to meet you, Gregorio, or to meet you, Vishen, or to meet you, Jackson, you know, to be with you in this moment. And then you realize that it's not just a concept that we're global humans at this moment. It's an actual fact. And that the leading edge of our species is this way. The leading edge is really about this consciousness. And there are more of us now than ever before. And I think our job is to create the pathways and to clear out the brush that needs to be cleared out for others to experience it through interactions with us and say, we want this as well, and then to watch it happen. Because there's really nothing more profound than watching somebody surpass you. You know, it's just, you know, oh, wow, the people I was talking with in Mind Valley, I was having conversations with people who were 24 years old and 35 years old. And there were some conversations that I really understood whoa, how you got there this quickly is beyond me, but I am so impressed. And I just immediately got the sense that that's happening. That's very inspiring. So I would say rewirement is connected to inspiration, to inspire, you know, to be that alive, to draw in a breath and to be, you know, led by that and to be inspired until I die. You never know when that's going to be, obviously. So you just say, well, what do I want to do with my time? Do I want to learn another piece of software or do I want to have an adventure? You know, sometimes it might be another piece of software, but I really don't have as much patience for that as I do for an adventure or an encounter. And being in another place is the real wild school, because once you're in a city like Barcelona, you know, you just realize that, well, I have to learn everything. Where do I live and how do I communicate and what's around the corner and who is Gaudi and wow, this is amazing architecture and who are these people that I'm, you know, interacting with. So it just wakes you up, and that's my aspiration for the rest of my life until I die. You know, I want to be all used up, you know. That's Bucky said, call me Trim Tab, and that's what he wants on his, and that's what he has engraved on his tombstone, meaning that I wanted to devote my entire life to what could one human being do on behalf of all of humanity. And I'm like in that world. That's sign me up for that camp. I want to go to that overnight camp. And I don't want to come home. I just want to stay in that overnight camp.
That's awesome. So if you want to connect with Phil and join him in that overnight camp and discover your own gifts and capacity to be what Buckminster Fuller called a trim tab, Phil has his book, The Future of Children, in which he outlines many of the stories of the inspiration, which also comes from some heartbreaks in the school, powerful examples of things that he's been through, 40 plus years working with kids, the heights that the kids have risen to, the miracles that have happened, the challenges along the way, and the principles that underpin this extraordinary experiment in education, which can be one of those little, what a trim tab is, it's a little piece on a rudder of a big ship that you make small adjustments and it can really change culture. So I encourage everyone to pick up The Future of Children, published by Emergence Education Press, to connect with Phil through trimtab.in, which is where this new initiative can be found, and to become part of this revolution in education, re-education, and transformation of the environment in which we're growing our next stewards of the future. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Amy. It's just been so wonderful to sit down and have this conversation with you. And I want to acknowledge the courage that you and Jeff have in creating Emergence Education, because it takes that kind of awakeness and leading edge consciousness to recognize that something has to be done in the area of publishing, but also in the area of interaction, whether it's on the internet, through the internet, or in groups, the way that both of you are doing. It's really important to acknowledge that these are the initiatives that are going to make a difference in the world. And to be a part of it is just a great privilege and honor.